tonight on The Download. Oscar-nominated director Jason Reitman. From New Order and Joy Division, Peter Hook. And singer-songwriter and Oak Park native Eleanor Friedberger. Now, here's your host, a man who wonders if there is any street in Chicago not under construction, seriously. Justin Kaufman.
It almost feels like there's some sort of invisible, silent, secret deadline that by Cinco de Mayo, all construction projects need to be done. Right? Does it feel that way? I don't know. Like I understand I live in a heavily populated, bustling area of the city of Chicago, close to downtown, but every single street has something going on, whether it's a lot that's being built up, turned into some big condo building, or a street that's being repaved, or construction turning three lanes to two or two to one. But it just feels, maybe it's just me, but it just feels like someone at the planning department of the city of Chicago just asleep at the wheel. Like maybe they're an improviser, this yes and. Yes, project, yes, yes, yes. It doesn't matter. There are I counted at one point, three of the four sidewalks on one block were closed to construction. Think about it, that's crazy.
So one of those things where, you know, we've had a colder than, I guess, a colder than normal.
Yeah. So maybe they couldn't get it done. Maybe. It just feels to me like someone's asleep at the wheel, like at the planning department. I mean, construction is a good thing. And it means that your city is moving, and I'm sure that that's also good that it's an election season in the sense that you want your roads and everything fixed and growth, and you look around, there's cranes. But I, you know, the old man in me comes, I don't like it.
Yeah, they should be tiered at some point. Yeah. You know, you do one street. Right.
It's driving me crazy. It took me 20, 25 minutes longer to get from, I mean, ridiculously close to the Trib Tower tonight.
Ugh.
Because every street is down to one lane. It doesn't matter.
I don't know how you do it.
Thank you. Thank you for... I mean, it's just... I'll get through it. It's The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. What a show tonight. We're going to watch this weather tonight. Thunderstorm warnings and watches. Severe thunderstorm warnings are in effect for DuPage County, Cook, Lake, Kane, everywhere. We'll be all over it tonight. We're watching a little rain coming through the area, and let us know in your area as well. 312-981-7200. Tonight, great show. Peter Hook, the famed member of New Order and Joy Division, is coming to Metro on Friday. He's playing some of his live albums. He's going to play in its entirety, Substance, from New Order. An amazing musician, one of the most iconic musicians on the planet. With us tonight, coming up right after the 7:30 news, Peter Hook. How great is that? He needs to know that Bizarre Love Triangles is still being played. Still being played on like three or four different radio stations. It's like, there's not a midday that goes by in Chicago where you don't hear... It's pretty great. Peter Hook on The Download tonight. Jason Reitman's going to join us. Oscar nominee, director, the... man who gave us Up in the Air. He gave us Juno with Diablo Cody. He's back together with her. She wrote the new film Tully. Jason Reitman, my guest at the big table tonight. Talk about filmmaking. Talk about the new film. Lots to do. I'm excited to talk with him. Always been a fan of his movies. He is evolving, and I wouldn't be surprised if Tully snags a couple of Oscar noms or buzz. It's early, though. It's May, right? They don't do that. You got to put that... Got to put Tully out in December, around Christmas time or something like that. Also tonight, Eleanor Friedberger, singer-songwriter, Pride of Oak Park, is coming through, playing Lincoln Hall this weekend. We'll talk about her new album, Rebound. Steve Dolinsky is in town. He's in studio. Steve Dolinsky, the Hungry Hound on ABC 7. He's also now Pizza Boy USA. Is that what he's going with? Pizza City USA? Chicago, he has dedicated his life to pizza, Chicago pizza. He really has. He's got a book coming out. He's got walking tours. You can go with Steve, and he can show you all the different kinds of pizza that Chicago has to offer in one walking tour. We'll talk to him about it as well, as this is the James Beard week, so we'll have that conversation as well. And coming up to Swap Meet with Greg Flamm. We got a huge show, so let's get to it. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break. We'll come back and do the carryout. So stay with us. Download 720 WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. All right, here are today's top stories. Former CPS chief Paul Vallis is officially in the race for Chicago mayor. Vallis took over the public schools back in 1995. He's held similar jobs, running school systems all over the country. He ran for Illinois governor before as well, losing to the primary to who was that? I forgot. He had a something itch. Blagojevich, right. Blagojevich. So what's he running on? Well, that the city of Chicago is in trouble because of the current guy. It's hard to run as a guy to replace the current guy when you're a guy who was aligned with the other guy who couldn't beat that one guy, maybe the worst guy in Illinois history. But I'm just a guy. What do I know? It'll be interesting to watch because Vallis has been around Chicago politics and he knows where all the new books and gift cards are buried. It's a CPS joke. Nobody? Oh, come on. President Trump let his lawyer go, Ty Cobb. And that's good, only for the reason that every time I read that his lawyer was named Ty Cobb, it confused the heck out of me. Ty Cobb? A different Ty Cobb? But he's got the same mustache. Cobb said he's retiring, but he also said he wasn't comfortable on the legal team because all the Mueller tweeting. Huh. Kind of like everyone on Twitter. The president apparently is replacing him with a lawyer who represented President Clinton during the impeachment days. I don't know. I'd rather have the lawyer that kept people from being impeached. I don't know, right? I guess... It's just me. Southwest Airlines reporting that there was another instance of a cracked window aboard a plane in flight. No injuries this time. Yikes. I'd be fine with a cracked window if, I don't know, my bags were free? Or I got a cheese plate? You know we're going to find out that the windows are cracking from someone throwing one of those complimentary Italian cookies at it. At this rate, was the only airline that you can trust Spirit? Really? Of course it is. Cambridge Analytics, the company that's in hot water for stealing Facebook data, is filing for bankruptcy and may shut down. Close up shop entirely. Well, they might just stay open so they can spy on their ex. The new Divvy dockless bike sharing program has been rolled out in some Chicago neighborhoods. Dockless bike sharing? Is that what happened to my bike 15 years ago? Was someone sharing it by sawing off a part of the wood on my back porch? I guess I was just ahead of the times. From here on out, I'm just taking bikes. A new report out says that youth sports is in trouble because they can't get enough referees or umpires to work the games. The report cites verbal and physical abuse from parents as some of the reason why people just don't want to do it anymore. What? Now how am I going to take out my frustrations about how crappy my life turned out? I mean, whether or not that ball was foul. Now how else am I going to prove to my son that I'm a man? That's what you do. That's a rites of passage, yelling at the umpire. How dare you call strike three? A new study out says that Illinois is one of the top states for mosquito-borne illnesses. Yes! In your face, New Jersey. How about that, Georgia? Huh? How you like your West Nile now, West Virginia? Holla! In weather? Of course, right? Thunderstorm warnings. It's all got to be ruined by rain. It's downright tropical in the Midwest tonight. Thunderstorms coming through because, well, it hit 85 today. So naturally, hazardous weather is right behind. The rain and the thunder is supposed to stay with us on and off through tomorrow night. The temps are going to drop back into the 70s this weekend, which is good for Chicago. It gives us a week or so to tighten up, right? I feel like this 80-degree weather week just came on as a surprise. We're all walking around like we're Brazilian beach bunnies. All these short shorts, me included. Tighten it up. You got a week. In sports, the Cubs and the Sox, both on losing streaks. The Cubs got blown out at Wrigley today by the Rockies. They lose two straight. They lose the series. Arenado and Charlie Blackman can ball. They're like today's Vinny Castilla and Dante Bichette. Rizzo and Bryant both homered today, and that usually means they win, but you know what? Who cares? It's early May. Here's a fun fact. Wilson Contreras had an error both as catcher and as left fielder today. Ah. Also, Darvish. Eeh, not good. Again, when do we start worrying? Can we set a date in June? Somewhere in there? The Cubs right now are only a half game back, heading into a big early season series against the division-leading Cardinals over the weekend. The Cardinals are on a two-game win streak because they played the White Sox. The Sox lost two close ones to the Cards this week. Yesterday, Shields pitched well enough to win, but closer Joaquin Soria blew the game. And today, Lucas Giolito was dueling. Man, he was great. Till, of course, the Cardinal pitcher Carlos Martinez hit a solo homer to give him a 1-0 lead in the sixth, two-out homer, first in his career. Ugh. The Sox are at least getting experience in different ways to lose. That's good. This is how you blow a save. This is how you let the opposing pitcher beat you. This is how you cheer too much during a home run trot. They're learning. The Sox are now 12 games under 500 for the season. They had a nice run to start the Royals series, and now they've dropped four in a row. The Twins come to town for a four-game set starting tomorrow night, but the rain, it's in the forecast, so like a long reliever, I'll be ready at a moment's notice. That's right, to give up like seven runs. NBA playoff action. Warriors got Steph Curry back last night, and they beat the Pelicans, go up 2-0. Nikola Mirotic, fouled out in the game with like 4 minutes to go. Who fouls out in the NBA? Also, Draymond Green. Are we sick of that dude yet? Anybody? I am. He's Rodman with a jump shot. None of the pizzazz. Yeah, put on a wedding dress, Draymond, and then we'll talk. And finally tonight, sad news, as the matriarch Florence Berman, co-owner of the famed hot dog stand Superdog, died at the age of 92, which just goes to show you, you can eat hot dogs and still live to 92. Tonight, let's all raise our dogs in her honor. Rest in peace. Next time I read a story about hot dogs are bad for you, remember that. That's the carryout for May 2nd, 2018. In honor of Florence's death, we removed all the ketchup packets tonight. Doesn't matter what you're eating. No ketchup. All right, coming up, Peter Hook's going to join us. The famed man behind bands like New Order, Joy Division. How great is that? He's going to be at Metro this Friday night. And coming up at 8 o'clock, Jason Reitman, filmmaker behind the new film Tully, joins us. So download 720 WGN. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, this Friday night, the place to be is Metro. Why? Because New Order's Peter Hook is back in town. Every time I think of you, I feel a shot right through a ball off the floor. It's no problem of mine, but it's a problem I find. Living a life that I can't leave behind. There's no sense in telling me the wisdom of the but that's the way that it goes, and it's what nobody knows. Well, every day my confusion grows. Peter Hook and The Light will take stage on Friday. The man behind bands like New Order and Joy Division is one of the most iconic musicians on the planet. He's touring to celebrate an anniversary of sorts. The New Order album Substance is 30 years old. The album was put out back in 1987 and featured a compilation of New Order singles up to that point, including Temptation, True Faith, and Bizarre Love Triangle. It's considered one of the best albums of all time. It's up there with the albums by Madonna and Prince for the best of the 80s, for sure. On Friday, Peter Hook is playing songs from Substance, both Substance albums, actually. Joy Division also put out a famed record by the same name, and Hook will play both albums live. He's a musician, a producer, and an author. In 2016, he wrote the book Substance Inside New Order, and it's my pleasure to welcome Peter Hook to The Download tonight. Peter, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Hello there. What a build-up.
Well, hey, it's deserved.
Like a great guy.
Well, I ask this of a lot of musicians when they come on to talk about, hey, what's it like to play Chicago, but it's historical record when you've played Chicago. Talk about an anniversary of sorts. 35 years ago, New Order came to Metro in 1983.
Yeah, I mean, it was the first time we met the wonderful man that is Joe Shanahan. And we had one of our most memorable gigs simply for the reason that it was something like 125 degrees on stage. And it actually prompted Joe to install air conditioning, which I'm sure a lot of Chicago over the years has been very grateful for.
That's right.
I know we were very grateful when we came back. But yeah, I mean, Chicago has always been a fantastic market for New Order. We were playing to, God, three times as many people in Chicago as we were anywhere in America very early on in our career. So I can only say that obviously Chicago has great taste.
It's great that you're coming back to Chicago, and it does go nuts when New Order and you particularly come to town. Talk about what it means to be on stage and to be able to perform both substances, the both the New Order and the Joy Division album to Chicago.
Well, at my age, I'm wonderfully proud of being able to perform in any way, shape, or form. I'm a musician. I've been a musician for 40-odd years. What I'm doing is that I'm taking a journey through all of Joy Division and New Order's LPs. I play the records in their entirety. There's no way that I can pretend to be the group. I wouldn't do that. So the thing is that I needed some way of being able to play the music and present it to the fans. To say I'm not pretending to be something I'm not. I'm just playing the music that I love more than anything else in the world. And it's great to play the LPs in their entirety, actually, because it was quite shocking when I realized how many tracks of New Order's that we had actually ignored as New Order. And the thing is that I don't get the opportunity to ignore them anymore. I have to play them regardless of how difficult they are to play, which is usually the yardstick for any group. If you've got a track on an LP that's difficult to play,
you generally just leave it and go on to
the easy ones that take the roof off. You know? so I don't have that luxury, but it's nice because I think it's a little more artistic, and I must admit that at this point in my career, it actually fulfills my keeps my concentration going. It makes it more difficult for the band, and also in many ways, it's actually more difficult for the audience. You don't get that sort of normal easy run, shall we say, that a group gives you when you play. They're a very thoughtful moment, shall we say. They're a very slow moments. And it's nice because people seem to relish the difference in tempos, you know, and the fact that it requires more thought, more concentration, but is ultimately much more rewarding.
1978 would be the 40th anniversary of Joy Division. Joy Division, and both New Order and Joy Division, share similar things in the sense that you were involved in both those bands, and you both created new genres. The Joy Division, you know, is punk music with a little goth thrown in, and then that turned into pop music with a little dance thrown in. And all of those things seem to be a start of genres that we know well today but didn't at the time. Do you see it that way? Do you see you being a pioneer in the way that Joy Division and New Order kind of took to the scene?
I don't see myself as a pioneer. I think I fought very bravely with music just to make sure that I didn't have to go back to work. So, luckily, I had a talent for it, talent that I only discovered at the ripe old age of 20. So, you know, there's hope for everybody out there. The thing is that you don't think about it in that respect. You know, you just do, and you use the chemistry of the individuals to write the music that you're all interested in at that moment. Mm-hmm. You know, over the years, tastes change, and our tastes had changed by the time we got to New Order. You know, we were sort of a man down by the time we got to New Order, so there was a different feel to what we were doing. Also, the 80s were a much different decade to the 70s. You know, that punk anger, all that aggression had seemed to have been tempered by a little bit of realism that age brings. So you were a different people, you know. I mean, you're very lucky in a group to change the world culturally and musically once. We were very, very lucky to manage to do it twice. It also helped that our record label was independent and had a very unusual way of working. It also helped that Chicago, of all places, inspired us to bring dance music to Manchester via our club, the Hacienda. You know, so there's a lot of history between the two cities, Chicago and Manchester.
Yeah, and
I'm very happy to, you know, say that chemistry is still there. I do think I've been lucky.
No, but I do. I know being a teenager and going down to Wax Tracks on Lincoln Avenue, and it was almost considered a Joy Division record store. It was a go-to. They had the sign behind the wall. But talk about Factory Records, of course, a huge player when it comes to independent punk music and I guess dance music of the 80s and 70s. But to think about how much there were at the time before the internet and before all that, that there were different places that were taking up the music that you were creating to almost be part of a culture. Did you know that was happening in places like Chicago or other cities you hadn't been before?
Well, I mean, we knew that Manchester at that time had a wonderfully rich musical heritage. You know, the thing is that every band that seemed to be coming along was adding to that huge history that Manchester had. Manchester really had a stranglehold over the world musically for a long, long time. It's sort of diminished now. I suppose in a way we're giving other people a chance, is the way I like to put it. But many of us are still very active, so you still get to take Manchester, Stone Roses, bands like that, you know, are still very influential today. But I mean, I don't know what it is about Manchester, if you're going to ask that. In the same way that Chicago was fantastic at house music, way ahead of its time, you know, there's no reason why, is there? It just happens at that particular point. But yeah, I mean, Manchester has been very lucky. It's enabled me to go right round the world, time and time again, playing the music that we wrote in the 80s and 90s, you know. And I'm certainly not complaining.
The tragedy of Ian's suicide in 1980, that album that came out right when that happened, and all of that happened after his death. What was it like as a musician to have your music become world famous after the band was over?
Well, oddly enough, we completely divorced ourselves from Joy Division because of Ian's very sad demise, and literally paid it no heed. We were very busy. We dropped every song. We started New Order from nothing, with no songs apart from two that we borrowed off Joy Division, that Joy Division hadn't finished, which was Ceremony in a Lonely Place. So we really did start at the bottom and earned our place, really, despite Joy Division. It was very odd. It was a bit of an out-of-body experience, actually, because our manager, God rest his soul, was always saying to us, you know, Joy Division are going to be as big as the Doors in 10, 15 years. It's just going to be like the Doors and all this lot. And really, it was of no interest to us. We really didn't look back. And I think that that was a sort of selfish way, as a youngster, of dealing with the grief. You know, as you get older, you realize that grief is a very, very important emotion, and you need to show respect, and you need to show empathy, and you need to, you know, do your bit at occasions like that. We were very lucky. We were musicians. Everybody says yes to musicians, to whatever they want to do for some unknown reason, which sometimes I'm happy about. But the thing is that we were allowed to ignore it and not grieve, if you like, throw ourselves headlong into New Order, and it worked. It made New Order far more successful than Joy Division ever were. Yeah. But Joy Division crept up and kept pace, and now are just as important, sell just as many records, if not more, than New Order. You know, and it's the most surprising thing in the world.
Yeah.
So the thing is that you just ignored it and got on with it. And then, you know, looking back now, I think that was a mistake we made at the time, but it was just the folly of youth.
I think of all the pop music that I listen to. I got a 10-year-old son, and he listened to the music stations and all of the dance music, almost EDM-inspired dance music that's being produced for Top 40 right now. I make the argument that that all comes from New Order, like that you can follow that to
well,
the 80s.
I'm very flattered, but I would have to give Chicago and Detroit a definite slice of that little pie from my point of view. If anything, I suppose you'd say that we brought a European feel to it, to that kind of music. But don't forget that we were taking influences ourselves from Kraftwerk, Giorgio Moroder, you know, Donna Summer, people like that were influencing us. It also coincided with a wonderful technological revolution. So we were all in the right place at the right time. A lot of that revolution was led by American companies. You know, Oberheim, Moog, they were the ones that pioneered electronic music, if you're going to be honest. You know, the Japanese sort of came afterwards, if anything, on that. So there was a lot of people involved in doing that. You know, the interesting thing is now is that the most commercial music is done the way that New Order decided to do their music in 1980, which is a combination of rock, normal acoustic instruments, and electronic instruments.
Right.
So I suppose that we were one of the first pioneers. Interestingly enough, if you read my book, Substance, Inside New Order, the interesting thing was how expensive, and, you know, it was very much a middle-class game, electronic dance music in the early 80s, because the instruments were so expensive.
Right.
It wasn't until the Acid House Revolution when technology, courtesy of the Japanese, became so cheap that everybody could do it. You know, now with a computer, anybody can do it.
It's amazing.
So I suppose you've watched a very different revolution.
That's right.
Those 3 points.
Well, if you want to see how it's done, New Order's Peter Hook will be on stage with Peter Hook and the Light this Friday night at Metro. He's going to be doing both substances, Substance from New Order and Substance from Joy Division, live on stage. Peter Hook, I can't thank you enough for taking some time out to talk
to
us tonight.
It was a pleasure to talk to you, and quite interesting history to go over, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks again.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Welcome back to The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the new film Tully is hitting theaters this week. It's a tremendous film about motherhood, starring Charlize Theron. It's about a mother of three and her friendship with her new night nanny. It's relatable, touching, emotional, and hilarious. It's written by Diablo Cody and directed by Jason Reitman, the team that gave us the films Juno and Young Adult. Jason Reitman was nominated for an Academy Award for Juno, and Tully is getting great reviews and great buzz as well. Reitman is a true cinematic force. He's directed Thank You for Smoking, Up in the Air, that's just to name a few. He's also made several short films, directed episodes of television. Tully is out in theaters this week, and it's my pleasure to welcome Jason Reitman to The Download tonight at the Big Table. Jason, thanks for being here.
Thank you, and what a lovely intro. Thank you very much.
It's a really outstanding film. I really enjoyed it. How did this film come about? Talk about your relationship with Diablo Cody, but what attracted you to this project?
I mean, you know, 12 years ago, I met Diablo for the first time, and I had just read the script for Juno and absolutely fell hard for it. And what I didn't know at the time was that this was going to be the beginning of a lifelong storytelling marriage. You know, we're 3 movies in now. We make movies every 5 years or so, and I really hope that continues for the rest of our life. You know, we're kind of writing this diary together. We're around the same age, and she writes and I direct these installments that relate to what we're each going through.
It really is amazing, and when you think about it that way, I'm not up on the history of Hollywood, but how often is it that a filmmaker will pair with a screenwriter and continue that relationship throughout their careers?
Perhaps more so, you know, in the golden age of Hollywood, you'd see those kind of pairings, but I just feel very, very lucky, you know. My other movies I write myself, but there's nothing like this relationship for me that I have with Diablo, where when she writes something, I know exactly what she means. And she usually is articulating something that I'm already feeling but don't have the words for.
I think the film is relatable. And you know, it's really about families. It's about pregnancy. It's about postpartum depression. There's a lot that goes into this film. As a director, does it have to be? Does the script have to be relatable?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think every film, to a certain extent, has to feel autobiographical. Not the plot, not the location, but what's underneath it. And I'm not a woman. I am a parent, but I'm not a mother. But I do know what it feels like to not know where you are in your own human timeline, to feel like you're too early for something or too late for something, or to feel as though you missed the on-ramp to life, you know, for some sort of event that you want to take part in. And that's what these films have been about. Juno is about growing up too fast and young adults about growing up too slow. This one, Tully, is about that moment in your life when you have a child and you dramatically have to close a chapter on your life because you have to stop occupying a space so that your child can occupy it instead.
Mm-hmm. Charlize Theron's getting wonderful reviews for her work, and she has been in the press a lot about getting ready for this role.
Yeah.
Talk about the importance of having Charlize in this film, because she really does an amazing job in the main character.
Well, I mean, you know, Diablo Cody and I guess we're a duo, and when we met Charlize, we became a band. And on Young Adult, I felt like we got to take advantage of Charlize's sense of humor, which had not had a proper showcase up to that point. She's darkly funny, cynical, and hilarious. And that discovery of that voice in Young Adult was just as much for me. And when we came to make this next film, I don't know how we could have done it without her. She just felt like an integral part of the team. And she's fearless. You know, these movies require a certain amount of bravery in that you have to stare down these flaws and perform them in a real way. You know, there's plenty of movies about parenting that are kind of slapstick and paint with a heavy brush. We wanted a version of parenting that you immediately recognize, that turns the movie screen into a mirror. And Charlize is totally willing to take on these roles and vanish into them and play the fear and play how alone it can feel in the middle of the night when you're parenting and you don't know what you're doing.
There's a great scene early in the film where her son Jonah is kicking the seat, and she's needing to find a parking spot because she's got to go into the school, and there's so much chaos going on in the car, and it's raining, and it just seems like this is going to be the moment for the film. I mean, there's so much intensity and tension. And you make the choice as a director to take this shot from outside the car, to show just the car, mm-hmm, and it just looks like nothing's happening. The rest of us, we're like, oh, it's just normal life. Like, you don't know the stress and the chaos that's coming in the car. There's something powerful about that.
You know, we constantly talk about how much our children are a blessing, and they are. But we don't talk about the moments in the middle of the night when we feel like we're failing them. We don't talk about the moments when we get so aggravated we want to scream, and sometimes we do. It's not easy. None of us gets an actual rule book, and it's way more emotionally complicated than it is normally portrayed on screen.
That's what I got from Tully, is the emotional complication. And the plot is great, and the story is great, and the humor is amazing in this film. But there's this complication in the mundane and routine. And I feel like your direction pulls that out. There's a point in the movie where you take what would be the routine of having a new baby, and you speed it up into a montage where it's 3 seconds of doing the same thing over and over and over. And it captures the idea of having a newborn. It captures that, how time flies away, but at the same time, it's having an impact.
Yeah, and I wish I could say I have some sort of master plan, and I wish I could say I know what I'm doing, but I don't think I do. I show up to set, and I, you know, react with my instincts, and I know the kind of feel I'm trying to create, and I go after it the best I can, and then we get to editing and we reshape it again. That sequence that you're talking about, that first month of having a child, that was on the call sheet every single day. We were doing a part of that montage every day. There were so many shots, so many setups and ideas. You know, we went to the cast, the crew, went to young mothers I knew, and I said, just give me ideas. Let me fill this montage with everything so that it's impossible to have a child and not see yourself in one moment of that montage.
Jason Reitman's my guest, the Academy Award nominated filmmaker. His new film is called Tully, starring Charlize Theron. She's amazing in it. The whole film is great. Comes out this week. We'll take a quick break, come back more with Jason Reitman at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio, filmmaker Jason Reitman. His film Tully is out in theaters this week. Talking about the film, but also about the process of making this film, because maybe it has something to do with the fact that I knew I was going to talk with you. But watching the film and watching the choices that were made for how you were setting up a bedroom shot or how you were setting up the routine, the montage we just talked about, it is very creative and very unique. When you start thinking about the scenes that are on the script, do you start thinking ahead of time of how you're going to shoot it? Or are you the kind of filmmaker that once you get in the moment, you let your gut take over?
I certainly read a script and there's shots that come to mind immediately. And I think every filmmaker is that way. Whether you're reading a book or a script, you're just, you know, you're imagining it. The movie is playing in your head. And what I do is a month before I start shooting, because I cannot draw to save my life, I go to the location with stand-ins and with a still camera, and I get the stand-ins to do the scene. I give them sides, and then, you know, I direct them a little. I say, why don't you go there, and you're going to sit down, and when you say that, you're going to stand up, you'll go to the door, and I have my camera with me, and then I just get them to do the scene, and every once in a while I tell them to freeze, and I start taking photos of all the shots, and I actually have all the cinema lenses marked out on my camera so I can take down the information. And from that, we create a booklet that is what we call photo boards, storyboards made from photos shot in the real locations with people, so that when the keys, you know, the cinematographer, production designer, key grip, gaffer, when they get to the location, they can look at this booklet and they know exactly what we're going to shoot. Right. All that is already figured out. At that point, the spontaneity is left to performance and solving things on the day, and the camera work I've already figured out.
How often do you use that booklet to inspire you for something more creative or something different than what you first set out to shoot?
At that point, I'm more inspired by the actors. You know, I have the booklet. I know what I want to shoot. That's the movie in my head. You can flip through the book, and it's like watching the movie. And at that point, you watch the actors, and you ask yourself if it's real. I mean, this was the advice my father gave me the night before I started shooting my first film. He said, don't worry if it's funny. Your barometer for comedy will never be as good as your barometer for truth. So ask yourself in every moment, do you believe this? Should the actor walk in the door that way? Should the conversation start here, or should you start on the third line instead? Should they actually get upset? Should they not get upset? Should they end the scene there? These are the things that you should be asking yourself. Trust that the script is funny and ask yourself, do I believe what's happening in front of me in every way? And use that question to address everything from acting to wardrobe, location, shooting, editing.
Well, I think about the scripts of Diablo Cody, and I think of Juno and of course, Tully here, and I'm blown away by the humor. And the lines on the paper, I'm sure, are very funny, but Charlize Theron in this film, when she hits a line, it is, you're right, it's truth. It's organic. It feels right. It's a out loud laugh in the theater because you weren't expecting it. And there's something amazing about the writing, of course, and the script that goes into it, but it's also about the performance and the direction to capture it. How much do you have to think of that as an organic moment, knowing that you have to hit that joke?
I never think about hitting a joke. I think I did on Thank You for Smoking, but from that moment on, I really kind of let go and started thinking more just about performance. And it's very funny. You know, Charlize does lines like, you know, she has a scene where she's over at her brother's house and he's rich and, you know, and she feels uncomfortable at his house. And his wife is talking to her about her own pregnancy. And Charlize starts referring to herself as this trash barge.
Yeah, right.
And the trash barge line is something that you're reading the script and it just seems kind of quirky and strange. And then Charlize reads it and it's funny. But not as funny as once you see it in a theater and you're in an audience and all of a sudden they burst out laughing and you're reminded, oh, that's right, this stuff's really funny.
I'm not, you know, I don't want to disrespect the work because you're in it and you're like, oh, this is not going to be a funny movie. And then that kind of stuff hits you and you're like, this is better than some of the comedy that's out there just for the lines that are put together.
What's humanist? And I think that's the key is Diablo's not trying to be funny. Diablo's trying to relate to the audience on a human level and trying to place moments from your real life that you don't normally see on screen, you don't normally see portrayed for all its flaws. And once you see it that way, you can't help but laugh at yourself.
But is that part of the attraction, this idea of this humanist approach that can bring you all the emotions, you could be drama at one point, it could be comedy at another, it can be emotional, it could be straightforward. I mean, are you looking for the full package when you pick a script?
You know, I'm looking to be surprised. And I feel like I so rarely am. I think everyone feels that way. I feel like TV shows, movies, in general, we've kind of gotten used to like, okay, it's one of these five things, and I know how it's going to play out, and then this will happen, that happen, the hero will do this, and the third act will be that. And Diablo always surprises me with her subject matter, the tone brought to that subject matter, the characters she chooses, how they change. I mean, look at Juno. I mean, you say it's a teen pregnancy comedy, and you presume, oh, okay, it's a Lifetime movie. It's like, no. It's going to be kind of this like sparkling comedy, and the young teenager will have this perspective. And then we're going to meet this 30-year-old guy who seems really cool, and we'll meet his wife, and she seems like a pill. But then halfway through the movie, you're ready to drop the guy, and this woman that played by Jennifer Garner, you fall in love with her, and all you want for her is to be a mom. And Tully is the same way. You know, it just kind of keeps surprising you. And the script surprised me, and I hope that the movie surprises audiences.
When you're working with someone like Diablo Cody and you have this opportunity to have this relationship where you do script after script and every 5 years you make a movie, and you also do your own movies, your own scripts, Do you find yourself being inspired by that relationship? Inspired? Do you find yourself writing in a different way based on the fact that you've had the success with these films?
I suppose it feels like a home base now. You know I can go try other things, and I know that I'm able to come back and do another movie with Diablo, and I'll always have this thing to return to that feels like our diary that we're writing together. The other movies, I'm exploring different ideas, and some of them connect and some of them don't. You know, Up in the Air really connected. Labor Day and Men, Women, and Children, not so much. But the exploration was exciting, and you know, growing as a filmmaker, even the painful parts were exciting, and it's comforting to always know. And I think I talked to other directors about this, and they're kind of envious that I found Diablo, because having that home base to go back to and right. know that she and I are on a kind of longer continuum maybe allows me to take more chances otherwise.
The film is Tully. It's out in theaters. Jason Reitman is the director. We're talking about the film tonight on The Download at the Big Table. We'll take a break for the news. We'll come back. Jason Reitman in studio tonight. We'll continue the conversation, so stay with us. Welcome back to The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio, Jason Reitman, the filmmaker of the new film Tully, which hits theaters this week. Great film starring Charlize Theron and written by Diablo Cody. We're talking about the process and also your career, Jason. You talk about the relationship you have with Diablo Cody, but you also talk about your own films. And also you talk about some of the films that are in between the ones that are mentioned in the lead. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot in this business about what have you done for me lately.
Mm-hmm.
And it's strange because when I think of you and your work and Juno and even Tully, I feel like you can do no wrong. So talk about that, being in this business, this Hollywood business, this filmmaking business, where there is this instant gratification, or tell me you're judged on what happened in your last project.
I mean, look, every director that I admire has had movies that didn't connect. That's part of it. You know, if that doesn't happen, you kind of have to question how much you were really trying. And now I've experienced that. And I've only been making movies for, I guess, 12 years now. This is my 7th movie. And I've, you know, experienced a broad range between success and failure. And certainly both have shaped me.
How important is failure in filmmaking?
I mean, I'll probably have a better answer for that question 10 years from now or 20 years from now. Right now, look, there was a moment coming off of three films that people would say very lovely things, and I perhaps believed it too much. And, it's good to be humbled, and it's good to be scared, and it's good to be hungry. And I think I probably brought those elements to Tully in my next film that I'm just finishing right now called The Front Runner, more so because of the last couple films.
Yeah, and I ask this of actors a lot. People forget, and you could be the number one star on Broadway, and that job lasts for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to get in line and audition for the next.
Yeah.
And you're not tall enough, or you're not right for the part. But failure or rejection is a big part of the world of actors and writers. Is it the same with filmmakers? Do you have to come to grips with the fact that, hey, there's going to be a lot of rejection in this business? Or is it something that you can pave your own way?
I mean, look, certainly. There was, you know, moments after Juno and Up in the Air when all kinds of screenplays were offered to me. Things as, you know, insane as Justice League. And then after Labor Day and Men, Women, and Children, not so much. And then literally, you know, Tully's coming out in a week. The reviews for it are good. And weird scripts are showing up again. So, yeah, I suppose that's part of it.
I always wonder, as well, as a filmmaker, and you said this and I've seen this in other stuff that you've talked about, you know, learning from your dad. And one of the things that you learned as a young filmmaker was to kind of debunk the myth or the magic of making a film and recognize that it's a job. And a lot of it is a job, but, you know, many of us in middle America would be like, oh, it must be great to make films. But it's a lot of work, and you have to find out at an early age that it is a job, and you have to be good at it.
And it's a privilege to get to direct. Very few people get to do it. It's expensive. It's more like architecture than playing the guitar. You want to play the guitar? Go buy a guitar. But you can't just, you know, build a building. So if you get to direct, then you have to really consider that privilege, you know, particularly as the business is changing. I mean, what makes me nervous is I don't know where people are going to watch movies a year from now or 10 years from now.
Right.
People are consuming entertainment in all kinds of different ways, and I'm in love with the theatrical experience.
Adam Pally was just in here on Monday talking about his films right to digital.
Right.
Netflix, everybody seems to be working these deals. Is there a future in which Jason Reitman skips the theater?
Probably. I love watching things on Hulu and Amazon and Netflix, and I certainly get that experience. I'm not immune to it. But I also love going to the movies. And I love buying a ticket and getting the popcorn, sitting down and watching the trailers. And there's a key element of it that I don't think gets spoken enough. People talk a lot about the size of the screen. People talk a lot about how good the sound is. And frankly, people have great screens and great sound at home. I don't think that's the argument. In fact, I go to the theaters all the time and I think, God, they need to replace the bulb on that projector. The real argument is there's very few places where you experience things with other strangers in a profound way. And when you're in a movie theater and you're surrounded by strangers and you start to cry or you start to laugh and you're all crying or you're all laughing, you're suddenly connected to humanity. You're connected to all these people you don't know, and it broadens you. These are important experiences, and that doesn't only happen in Marvel movies. Marvel movies are great. Star Wars movies are awesome. But I'm interested in what happens when you need to see Little Miss Sunshine and be surrounded by a bunch of strangers and be moved by something small that changes you. And I think it happens in a different way when you're in a theater than when you're alone at home.
As a director and as a creator, do you think about how people are going to watch it? Do you think about that moment? Does it affect you when you're in the creative process about, like what you just said, this idea that strangers could be together and they could be moved all at once? Does that inspire you? Does it motivate you as a filmmaker to make the product?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think about film festivals a lot. You know, film festivals made me want to be a director, and bringing my films to film festivals kind of defined me early on. So I think about, like, even specific theaters I know at different film festivals and how they would react. And I love, there's moments of each movie that I love to be in the audience for as they play. Even the cruel ones, you know, and Up in the Air, which I think it's, you know, it's long enough ago that I can ruin the ending. you know, when he shows up at our door at the end of Up in the Air, I love to be in the theater for that. It's a heartbreaker, but it takes the audience by storm, all of them, all at once. And that's really exciting for me.
Well, the new film is Tully. It's hitting theaters this week. It's a film starring Charlize Theron, written by Diablo Cody and directed by Jason Reitman, my guest tonight. Jason, thanks so much for taking some time to talk to us and be my guest at the big table. Good luck with the film.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to be at the big table and talk to you. Thanks again.
Yeah, that story about the 15-year-old kid as well, and Rob will tease that out when he does the news. He was on a CTA bus. That ain't right, man.
It's not right, and the reaction, and I will play a clip here from Superintendent Eddie Johnson, was, I think, spot on. He was not happy.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, if you're going to be 15 or 16, no one should be shot in any situation. But, you know, obviously a lot of teenagers are into trouble and they get into gangs and things like that. And you can read, you can easily desensitize yourself and be like, a 15-year-old shot. Okay, well, you know, what were they doing? But a 15-year-old riding a CTA bus. And it was from the outside, right? Like
it was from the outside, and it actually came from a couple of blocks away. And he was just sitting there minding his own business, coming from school.
Oh, that hurts, man. Yeah. So. All right, well, that's coming up at 9 o'clock, but that's a terrible story.
Yeah, it is.
All right, the weather, of course, a big story, and we will keep you up to date on that. About every 10 minutes or so, Rob. But, you know, as I said, most of the warnings have turned into watches. You still got the big stuff up in McHenry and Boone and also in southern Wisconsin. That area, a lot of weather coming through that area right now, so we'll pay attention to that. And of course, every time, and I always feel bad about this, but we're always like, oh, the watch is over, but the weather just moves east, and it's still our listening region. Like, you think about the region, you think about Northwest Indiana and Indiana, like, you know, you down and look at the places that are listening right now in Merrillville or Valparaiso or places like that, and you're like, ah, it's all gone, it's not raining here anymore. And they're like, hello, yes it is. So, of course, a lot of those weather systems heading out east of Chicago right now, and we'll stay on top of that story. Awesome to have Jason Reitman here, huh? You know, I really, and like I said to Roe and Anna earlier, I'm no Richard Roper. And he gets paid the big bucks because he knows how to identify, and he and Dean Richards and others, they do a great job of doing reviews. I'm not a reviewer. I go to see the films because I'm going to talk to the director. And, you know, that's usually how I approach it. And I really liked this movie. Like, it was one where I was like, wow, this is good stuff. And a lot of it, the plot is awesome. The script, Diablo Cody, made me laugh out loud 10 times. But the other thing about it, and Charlize Theron, I think she should get an Oscar nom for it, but I also would say his directing is so good, so creative.
Mm.
Yeah, there were a lot of times where I was like, wow, that could have been shot a lot of different ways. And the way a lot of lighting, a lot of interesting ways that they show night, because the story is that she gets a night nanny. You know, she has her third kid, and her world is kind of crashing in around her, so her brother recommends a night nanny, and she gets a night nanny. And so all of the action kind of happens at night for the newborn and the conversations and everything. So it's a lot about nighttime, and it's all around night, and the way that he does the lighting to show it's really good.
Yeah, because you see a lot of movies for people that we have coming in, and I'll always ask you, like, when you get back from the screen, how was it? And most of me, oh, it's good, you know. Yeah. It's good. I liked it, you know. Like,
go to my website, justincoffin.com. It was good.
I mean, you like most of that, you know. I mean, they're all pretty good. You know, you can find something that you like and that you can connect with. But
I liked it a lot. And I remember last year there were a couple of films we did. You know, we talked with the director who did Ghost Story and The Florida Project. Oh, gosh. And I remember coming out of those films going, is it me? Was that totally moving? And Jason Reitman talks about it at the end of that interview. He talked about this idea that going to the theater means something. It's not because of the sound or the size of the screen. That seems to always be the Hollywood argument. You've got to see it in the theater. When we heard from, I feel like we're piecing together the whole argument, because we heard from the guys from Broken Lizard the week before saying the reason they push this experience, this theatrical experience, is because that's what they count for money. Like, they don't have this relationship with home sales. Super Troopers 2 can do $600 million in sales or home sales, but they don't talk to each other. They only did $5 million in theatrical sees it as a bomb. And so there is always this push from the theatrical arm of Hollywood to say, you got to see it in a theater. It's so great. It's so big.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's so loud. Oh, the sound. You can't get the sound. Come on. Have you been to Best Buy or any to Apt and you see all the electronics? You're like, oh, my God, you don't need the theater anymore.
More often than not, I'm saying turn it down.
Exactly.
Too loud.
You go up to the... The guy in the booth at the AMC. Excuse me. Could you just turn it down just a second? But his point was spot on, is that there are fewer and fewer opportunities for any of us to get together with strangers and have any sort of moment that moves us. And that could be excitement. I mean, still kind of get that in bars, at sports bars, when you get together to watch.
Yeah.
You know the feeling if someone scores a touchdown or I don't know, the Bulls are in the playoffs and the Hawks are in the playoffs. That's a big part of the experience. You almost don't want to watch it at home. You want to go watch it with people. And I think that there is something to be said about that, because movies like Tully or even some of the other movies that I just saw in the theater, you do have this moment where you're having this collective thing.
Yeah.
It lives and breathes with complete and utter strangers. And that's why I joked at the beginning of the week, I went and saw Infinity War with my son. And we went to see it, and it was a big surprise. I surprised him. And I kind of did the same thing we did with Star Wars. I'm like, oh, we're not going to movies. Yes, we are, which is totally going to screw him up. Anytime there's going to be any blockbuster, he's like, are we really going to the grocery store? I'm like, yes, we are. But so, you know, we went to see it, and it was packed theater, and everybody's in there in the anticipation for it. There was also great moments. There was really interesting moments where people cheered when some of their superheroes came on the scene. It was a Friday night that it opened. So, like, I started to cheer a couple of times.
You did?
I did, yeah. For Captain America. When Captain America shows up in Avengers, he's like, you know, into the movie a little bit, and he shows up like, I have a problem with that. You know, and like, who's going to stop me? I will, you know. And I'm just like, yeah. Smattering of clapping. Everyone's like, yeah, Captain America. Yeah. And then the same with the Guardians of the Galaxy. When they show up in the film, you automatically know, and everyone kind of gets a little, there's smatterings throughout the theater, and it's kind of this emotional moment together.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Or when people clap at the beginning when the Marvel stuff comes on, or when it says Infinity War, or at the end when it's over. But I told you, my son had this moment where he had been duped so many times by this film. Everyone knows the lead up to this film. It's all about, could this be the end of certain superheroes? Superheroes from the last decade or so. And there's a lot made of it. If you go on the internet, that's been all of it, you know. And I'm not talking spoilers. I'm talking that's, you know, the theories moving in. That's what Infinity War is. If you watch the comic books, it's the end of the line for mm-hmm. some. And that's just not done. Most of the times you do, you know, big movies like this, it's, you know, the superhero wins in the end. So that's why it's intense. And so there's just all this, is this it? And the movie, and like I said, the movie knows it. That's what really annoyed me about the whole thing. So the movie knows it, so they're like, oh. Yeah. And it's really funny because the every turn, they'll be like, and this is not the end. And you're like, and my son just totally got duped.
Oh.
There was a moment where Thanos is just fighting, you know? Like, for me, he's a huge purple monster with strength as big as a planet. And there's a couple times where he punches somebody, you know, like a like Scarlett Johansson or a, you know, a Liam Hemsworth or Hemsworth or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you're like, yeah, that would kill somebody.
Yeah.
But they don't ever die. Uh-oh. They just like, oh, I'm up. Shake it off. You know, so like I understand like the reality is twisted a little bit. But there's this moment where Thanos is punching the superheroes in this fight. And it gets to a point where it gets quiet. And I just hear my son, my 10-year-old son, audibly sobbing. Like crying as if this was a huge moment. And I'm like, it's not that big of a moment. Like I kind of was like, at first I was like, oh my, is he hurt? Like I was protection, like I had protection came on. But then I was like, what are you doing? Like I was like, no, you're crying at the wrong time. Right? You're crying at they're not dead. They're still alive. The movie's tricking you. So I kind of got mad at Avengers. I was like, you made my son cry at the wrong times. And then I mercilessly
heckled him
all weekend.
Yeah. That'll stick. That's going to stick.
I know. Every time I did it, but I was like, the comic in me couldn't stop. I don't know. Do you want to audibly sob about this? I can't. How are those chicken nuggets? Yeah? Do you want to cry about those chicken nuggets? No, I didn't. But that moment, it was almost like he was having that, we're talking about the theatrical moment. He just was off. But yeah. I think everybody was looking for that moment to share with everybody at that theater.
Yeah, because when I go see a movie and then people clap at the end, I'm annoyed. I get annoyed when people are clapping at the end. I'm like, they're not on stage.
Yeah, right.
But then when I go to like the music box for the Christmas things,
oh,
that's an experience. Like you, like at the Avengers, yeah, see, right. Same thing. Like when James Stewart comes on the screen, people clap at the end. It's clapping. You're part of
the
thing. Yeah, so I can totally see that happening at one of these huge, you know, superhero movies.
630 says, Tully is a ball of feminist bleep about how many women are spoiled and don't know how to be proper mothers. What? Did you see the movie? The movie doesn't come out till tomorrow.
Somewhat recommended.
That's ridiculous. That's like they saw the blurb in Time Out and they're like, nah, I don't like that blurb. I don't know. I'm going to need to go to the internet. Where can I write it? Someone, I got to write it.
Real quick, I was taking the bus home from the Cubs game on Saturday, and I happened to notice a guy reading a Tribune article next to me, and I just kind of looked down to see what he was writing, and then I, you know, just doing something else, and I looked down again, and I look in, and I go, he's posting a comment. I'm like, oh, I'm sitting next to a commenter, you know, like a commenter.
Right.
Like, you never know who these people are.
You should have got a selfie with him.
I was like, this guy's a cuz. I'm waiting to see... waiting to see what he writes, and his comment was, drop dead, period, you orange turd, period. That was his comment. Post that,
I am a star.
Who's he talking about?
Who's he talking about? I think he's talking to Chester Cheetah. Maybe he's not a fan of Cheetos. I don't know.
He's the new sensation in the nation, Pizza Boy USA. He's the flying saucer innovation, Pizza Boy USA. He's getting ready now, listen to that crowd. He's a Pizza Boy USA.
Toss a pizza, roll a pizza up and all around.
Here's the Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest has spent the better part of the last 3 years eating pizza. All kinds, thick, thin, deep dish, stuffed, wood-fired, you name it, all of it. Research for Steve Dolinsky's new book, Pizza City, USA, 101 Reasons Why Chicago is America's Greatest Pizza Town, out this fall. But that hasn't stopped Steve from jumping ahead to bring his knowledge to the masses. He's begun a series of walking tours, certain Chicago neighborhoods, to get a sample of why he believes that Chicago is second to none when it comes to pie. Steve Dolinsky is, of course, Chicago's number one foodie. The journalist goes by The Hungry Hound for his broadcast on ABC 7 and is the producer and host of The Feed podcast with his co-host, Chef Rick Bayless. He's won a gazillion James Beard Awards, which, by the way, are this Monday in Chicago. And he's in studio tonight. Steve, good to see you, bud.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on,
and
Justin.
You brought in pizza as well.
I brought you pizza, of course. I'm the pizza boy,
How
USA.
Are you not sick of pizza by now? You've been eating at your Instagram feed. Everything that I know about you, every time I've seen you in the last 3 years, you have pizza in your mouth.
Every other post is a pizza post. I get it. I did a pizza tour today, actually, for some concierges and for some press. It's a lot of pizza. But I gotta do this because it's all about, for the next couple of months, before the book comes out, we started this pizza tour business just this week. And so I've got to live the brand.
Okay, so I know you as a big-time foodie and a guy who has such an adventurous palate. You've always been the guy who's at the cutting edge. You'll be the first to be trying foods that no one's tried before or trying to bring this kind of stuff to the masses. Pizza's always been one of those foods that is more a little general, right? It doesn't fit into that category. What is it about pie that got you so into it?
Well, it's universal. And you know that from my reports at ABC 7, I love doing like the obscure Thai place with the cow soy, and I get excited about that kind of stuff too. But I found whenever I did something about barbecue or pizza, but especially pizza, people would really respond. And they responded from every nook and cranny. And people always joke like, oh, everybody loves bacon. Well, actually, no, not everybody loves bacon because they're vegetarians and there are people who keep kosher and they're Muslims. And people love pizza though. Everybody's got a story about pizza. And the cool thing about pizza in Chicago is there's this thing I say in the book called the Pig Syndrome, the pizza I grew up eating syndrome.
Right.
It's like if you're from Homewood and Flossmoor, man, you are an Aurelio's person. You think that's the best pizza in the world. I would disagree. If you're from the West Side, you're probably an Armand's person. If you're from the North Shore, you're a Barnaby's person. You know, that is the thing about Chicago. And so people were really enthusiastic, passionate, excited about these posts that I was making on my original pizza crawl. So I thought there's something here. Yeah. And when I pitched this idea to Northwestern University Press about a book, they were like, absolutely. This is something that has a lot of legs to it.
I won a bet with my wife and the bet was get to pick a restaurant. And I said, I want to do a tavern style pizza place. And I mentioned it. It was right after the Oscars, whoever got the most categories, right? And I'm like, well, I'm going to pick a tavern style place. And I was hosting Cochran, Steve was out, and the amount of response, it was hundreds of places. People were like, I will buy you come and tell them Jimmy sent you. I will buy it. It's the best pizza ever. You'll never have another slice of pizza like this in Bedford Park, whatever
and,
it was.
Right. But and you'll get hundreds of responses for tavern style in Chicago, but you'll get maybe one for deep dish. And everybody from outside of Chicago always says, oh, Chicago style, that's deep dish. Like I was in Brooklyn last weekend and the guy said, oh, you're from Chicago? I don't like that pizza. It's like, but you don't understand. Chicago style means thin.
Yeah,
Chicago
right.
style is tavern style pizza. When I did this research, 185 places around the region, and I called them up anonymously ahead of time, hey, what are you guys known for? What's your big seller? It was always a thin crust, a tavern style,
square
cut, thin, party cut. Yeah, the thin and crispy. That's Chicago style pizza, and that's what I'm trying to communicate in this book.
Why is it, do you think, that the national reputation of Chicago when it comes to pizza is the deep dish? Is this, I mean, where does that come from?
Well, because it's so unique, because nobody has it outside of Chicago. You cannot find it on the East Coast. There's maybe an Uno chain, which is not, you know, Uno's not even a Chicago company anymore. And it's just so, it's like this weird alien thing. And it's, you know, it's been here since 1943, so it's not like a newcomer. But it is this thing that people just don't see in their hometown pizza places. And so they always say, oh, that's the Chicago style. But here's the interesting thing. When people like Jon Stewart make fun of Chicago pizza,
right.
they always show a picture in the over-the-shoulder of a Giordano's, of a stuffed, of something
right.
from Super
right.
Rosa,
right.
right? And you know what stuffed is? That's the cheese on the bottom, the ingredient, the ingredients in cheese. And then another layer of dough on top of that, and then the lake of sauce. That is not deep dish. That is stuffed. It's a different style of pizza created by Giordano's in 1974 and Nancy's, right? That's not
right.
deep dish. So, but the reason people from out of town get so crazy because it is this weird anomaly that they've never seen before.
Oh, that's interesting because I as a Chicagoan, always mistake that because I would always think Giordano's because it's style and Gino's and things downtown, they are, that's deep dish even though that's stuffed.
No, it's not. I mean, well, they do stuff. Some do stuffed and some right. do deep. Like Gino's is not a stuffed place. It's a deep place. And Giordano's right. is a stuffed place, really, not a deep place. But the weird thing is that the people just, they'd see that picture and they think Chicago. Right. And it's just, I'm really trying to get them out of that mindset.
How can, talk about the walking tours, because you're doing, like you said, you were just here doing pizza all day. Where's this idea come from?
Because, again, people come to Chicago, they spend all their time down here on Michigan Avenue, and they go to all the deep dish places. And I feel like Chicago's a city of neighborhoods, right? And we want to get people outside of this downtown core. I mean, we love it down here. It's beautiful. But I think West Town's interesting. I think Bucktown's interesting. I think West Loop is interesting. And so I've set up tours that tackle four different styles of pizza in 3 hours. I think that's really about as much as people can stand is 3 hours of pizza eating. But I think four styles is great. And so one of the reasons we're not doing South Side as much is because the South Side basically is a lot of the same tavern style, right? If I want to go to Vito and Nick's all the way down on the Southwest Side, where am I going to find three other styles of pizza? And so I can find
you're
in
looking
West
for the variety, right?
In West Town, I can go to Coal Fire for a New York style Coal Fire
place.
Pizza, beautiful,
yeah.
right? Artisan pizza.
Yep.
Then I can walk over to Salerno's and have a tavern style. I can walk to D'Amato's and get a Sicilian slice.
You're
I can walk to
right.
Pico
yeah.
Lasagna and get a Neapolitan.
Those
right?
are completely different styles
Very
of pizza,
different.
All within three blocks.
That's yeah. what I'm, and that's what the book is getting at, like the 10 styles of pizza we have in Chicago. If you go to Bucktown, you can go to My Pie for another great deep dish, by the way, that no one knows about. People on the tour, we did the friends and family, they were like, I didn't know this was here even. And My Pie's been around, you know, since
years,
the 70s.
Yeah. Yeah.
We go to Demos for a slice. We go to Kraft for artisan. We go to Bonchi, this new Roman Altaglio style. So there are four different styles there. We go to West Loop. We do Lou's, of course, for a deep, but then we do Forno Rosso for Neapolitan. We do Bonchi for Roman. We do a Sicilian slice at Nona's. So you can get,
oh my God.
People don't realize. When I talk to people from Chicago, they're like, well, I've been to Lou's. And I've been to the neighborhood place in my neighborhood, and that's about it. They don't get out.
How's
much.
How's your sweating? Are you sweating a lot?
like pepperoni sweats? No, but the cool thing about the eating all this pizza, I'm this is just crazy. I'm going down this whole rabbit hole. Italian sausage, you take it for granted in Chicago, right? It's on every pie. It was created in Chicago on pizza. When you go to New York or you go to the East Coast, sausage there is sliced like it's off of, it looks like gyros.
Yeah, you're right.
It's always sliced.
Yeah.
And there's no fennel and garlic like here. It's like in jagged, rugged pieces. I brought you some labriola here from down the street. They got I brought a deep dish and I brought a Chicago style thin. And this Italian sausage, he does Russo sausage from All Sip from the South Side. And it's got that jagged, rough, garlicky fennel. I love those nooks and crannies.
Oh,
very different than on the East Coast. And so that's what's cool about Chicago style as well.
Steve Dolinsky here. His new book coming out, Pizza City USA, 101 Reasons Why Chicago is America's Greatest Pizza Town. It's out this fall, but he also has the walking tours. We're just about to start. PartyCityUSA.com.
Pizza City.
Pizza City. What
Pizza
is it?
City
I know,
USA.
I have it written.
That's okay. PizzaCityUSA.com.
PizzaCityUSA.com to get more information on the walking tours. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk more pizza. And, of course, the James Beard Awards, which are coming up here on Monday. Stay with us.
Make a dance, take a chance, up and all around the pizza boy. Look at it go. Make a dance.
Pizza boy, Steve Zielinski.
Oh, my God.
No.
That's my new name of the office.
I know.
Hey, pizza boy.
Hey, pizza boy. PizzaCityUSA.com is the place to find Steve Zielinski's information for his walking tours. Different neighborhoods to really give you a slice of Chicago
yes.
pizza.
We do a bus tour once a week.
Gosh, man.
Four
where do you find the time?
Four neighborhoods.
Because you're still working all the time on ABC. You do the podcast, the feed.
Yeah, but you know what? I've got a daughter in college. She doesn't need me anymore. And my son is a junior in high school. He's busy. He's driving around. I mean, they don't need me anymore, Justin.
You motivate me. You inspire me all the time. Because whenever I feel like I'm too busy or I feel like I want to start complaining, I go, what would Steve Dolinsky do?
Yeah.
He would not be complaining. He'd be picking up another job. That's what he'd be doing. So get out there.
Thank you. I'm glad I inspire you, Justin. That's so
you and I, 20 years ago, won a James Beard
that.
Award. I found the picture. I've been going through some stuff because we're going doing Schadenfreude's 20th anniversary is this year. And 1998, I found this picture of you and I in tuxedos winning a James Beard Award 20 years ago this week.
A lot of hair, too, then.
Yeah,
that's
right?
funny, yeah.
Amazing. I mean, you were up for James Beard this year for the gazillion time. You did not win, which I don't know who you were up against, but it was you got robbed?
I did. It was
you got robbed?
Best TV segment for food segment on a non-food show. That was the category. TV segment, food segment, non-food
and
show.
And that was out in New York.
It was out in New York. Yeah, they do the book broadcast and like media awards, journalism awards last Friday in New York City. Those awards will always be in New York because the whole publishing industry is there.
Yeah, right.
So we were up against PBS. We lost to PBS. But it was nice to be nominated. It's nice to be there. You know, people are like, oh, you're the guy from Chicago.
Do you present?
I did not present. They didn't ask
me. You know what? Don't get me started, man.
I know.
I find they had
Tamron Hall was the MC. She did a great job, by the way. She's very good. Yeah. Former Chicagoan.
Former Chicagoan. All right. So the James Beard Awards for the food side of it is this Monday here in Chicago. It's, of course, become an annual tradition. How does Chicago look when it comes to the categories like chef and restaurant,
good.
Things like that?
Pretty good. You know, we got Outstanding Baker nominee, Outstanding Pastry Chef in the Country nominee, Outstanding Restaurant Tours, the Boca guys. Every nominee in the Great Lakes category for chef is from Chicago.
Wow.
So there will be a Chicago winner there. Rising Star Chef from the chef from Lula and Marisol. Sarah Rinkavage is up. So there's a couple of national awards potentially for us. But, you know, it's at the Civic Opera House Monday night. There's a ton of stuff this weekend, actually. This is probably the busiest. It is. This is kind of the busiest. Well, it's always been a busy weekend, but because Chicago's hosted it now for a couple of years and we've got it until 2021, the local food industry has really sort of just taken it in and opened up to the public, and they've given tickets now. And so it's not just an industry thing. When you and I went 20 years ago, it was like you had to be a nominee to go to stuff. And now it's like if you want to pay $50, you can go to a cool cocktail event. And there's all these pop-ups from these really cool bars, like Trick Dog from San Francisco is coming in. Guys from New York are coming in to do pop-ups from the Nomad Hotel. And so you can go to these events Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, which is really cool.
Wow. Well, yeah, it's amazing. Think about it. You don't have to go rent your tuxedo from Genghis like I did.
You rented then. Yeah, I know. I think I had to buy one, unfortunately. But yeah, that was a...
I took it on the plane with me to New York because I was 21 God. Years old or whatever at the time. Like, this is there a place I can put this?
You look like... you're so funny when you were in that picture with the tux.
Yeah, a lot of sideburns going on.
So great.
You know, back to pizza, it is something I joke with you about, you know, the idea of where you find the time. Do you see this being a future for you, the idea of you being the face of Chicago pizza, doing this over and over for people coming in?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, I never imagined that it would be like this, but because of this interest in the book, I'll see how the book sells, I guess, and because of the interest in the tour so far, we've been online for 2 days. This could become my thing. I mean, there could be worse things. You know, like Abe Froman was a sausage king of Chicago, you know, and Ferris Bueller, maybe Steve Dolinsky is the pizza king of Chicago. I don't know. Dolinsky is not really a pizza name. It should be more Italian.
Are you not like the wine tours or when you go to a winery, do you spit your pizza out? Do you take a bite?
You know what, though? I do. I don't finish a slice typically, unless it's a little small, tiny square slice. I typically do not like, we're looking at this huge Labriola deep here. I would have like two bites of that thing and probably call it a day.
What makes this pizza, this Labriola does a stuffed, it's not stuffed, it's a deep dish here. What makes this pizza the number one on your list?
So at the bottom crust is crispy, first of all. That's a big key component for me. I mean, this has been sitting for a bit, but typically when you get in the restaurant, you could almost pick it up with your hands. You don't need a knife and fork. It's a crispy bottom. It holds its shape. There's corn flour, there's corn meal, and there's corn oil in this to bake it. He puts little Calabrian chilies in with the sausage. There's a little bit of cayenne in the sauce. There's pecorino romano grated on top. It's just a little bit nicer than the typical average deep dish. And this outside perimeter on the upper edge, it looks like a Pequod's. It looks like a Detroit-style pizza. It's kind of a burnt, crispy, cheesy crust that gives you some texture. I like texture with my cheese. There's one of the terms in the book. This is a very important term: OBR, optimal bite ratio. You don't want to have a mouthful of cheese and dough with pizza. That's typically a stuffed pizza.
Yeah, right.
They show those sexy, you know, sort of Instagram shots of pulling the slice away with the cheese lava coming out of it. That doesn't appeal to me. That's just a mouthful of melted cheese in a bowl. I want to have dough and sauce and topping and cheese all together in every bite, and a little bit of crunch in there as well. I don't want to just have soft, flabby. I want to have crispy, crunchy, and also some sort of oozy cheese.
Before I let you go, a loss for the Chicago culinary community today.
Yeah,
the matriarch really of Superdog.
Yep.
It's her imagery on the top of Superdog. She died.
Yeah, with her late husband Maury Berman. Flory Berman passed away overnight, and we want to wish her family the best and that we're thinking of them. She was amazing. I mean, I had done stories on her in the past when they celebrate their 60th anniversary up on the Northwest Side. Superdog is Chicago. And you cannot get more local than that. And so, you know, her pass passing is a major thing in Chicago, because she and Maury were that restaurant.
Yeah. Steve Dolinsky, you can see him on ABC7, of course, as the Hungry Hound. He's also got the Feed podcast he does with Rick Bayless. And now the walking tours, Chicago Pizza Walking Tours. You can find it at pizzacityusa.com. The new book, Pizza City USA, 101 Reasons Why Chicago is America's Greatest Pizza Town, will be out this fall. And you got to come back and continue the conversation. Steve, great to see you. It's been a good 20 years.
Thanks, Justin.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're coming up on Saturday. The place to be will be Lincoln Hall, Chicago. Welcome home, Eleanor Friedberger.
I feel just as crazy as I did last night. I feel like I'll get up and go. Today I'm frozen, but tomorrow I'll write.
Eleanor Friedberger is a singer-songwriter from New York City, but she grew up right here in Oak Park. She broke on the scene as one half of the brother-sister duo Fiery Furnaces, but that was closer to a decade ago. Since 2010, Friedberger's been recording and touring as a solo act and has produced 3 studio albums. In 2016, she released New View and the song we just heard. He didn't mention his mother. And coming up on Friday, her 4th album will be released. It's called Rebound, and here's a track from it called Make Me a Song.
A pre-dawn song.
Friedberger is currently doing a mini tour to support the release of the record, coming to Lincoln Hall on Saturday and coming to Reckless Records in Wicker Park for an in-store on Saturday afternoon. She's with me tonight on The Download. Eleanor, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
As I said, you grew up in Oak Park. Is it special to come back to Chicago to play places like Lincoln Hall because you grew up in this area?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm really so lucky that my parents still live in the house that I grew up in on Oak Park Avenue, which is pretty unusual. So coming home is like, you know, walking into a museum of my childhood or something. And yeah, no, I mean, it's really cool that I get to drive along North Avenue until I can't drive any further. And then, you know, come back home after the show and park in the alley and all that kind of stuff. It's pretty great.
Can we chart your musical evolution from your days in Oak Park with Fiery Furnaces and your brother? Music is a family affair. What do you keep with you from your experience growing up in that area?
Well, my grandmother was the choir director of Assumption Church on the west side, mm-hmm. which is right off of 290. It's a Greek Orthodox church. So I grew up kind of watching and listening to her singing. And I was also, I don't want to give too much notice to other radio stations, but I grew up like loving the oldies, and I listened to Magic 104, and then
that's okay, it's not around anymore, so that's okay.
105.9, you know, that was,
yeah, right.
I was, you know, like really a child of that kind of like strict, regimented radio that, you know, turned me on to so much great music. But, and I also, most importantly, lived a walking distance from a place called Secondhand Tunes in Oak Park, where you could go down and buy like every great record for a dollar, you know, when I was a kid. And that was, you know, I was really lucky for that.
Well, the new album's out coming up here on Friday. It's called Rebound. And as you mentioned, just with your grandmother, with the choir at the church, Greece plays a big part. Mm-hmm. I was reading about your trip to Greece and how it inspired you for this record. Talk about how the club Rebound and all the story that helped inspire this record that we're about to hear.
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time in Greece, more like on beach holidays with my family over the past 20 years, and I'd never spent much time in Athens, only for a day or two, and I was really curious about what it was like as a place to live. And one of my favorite things is like just getting to know a city and walking around for hours and feeling like I live there. And usually on tour, you know, you only get a day or two to do that. So I was excited to really like immerse myself in that city, especially after the election. And, you know, since I moved to upstate New York, I've tried to get away for parts of the winter. So I did that. And Athens for me is just, and Greece in general, such a special place because it has this perfect mix of like foreign and familiar. I can kind of pass for being Greek. If I say a few words, I can pull off the accent and I look vaguely Greek, but then, you know, then immediately I get busted for not actually knowing how to speak. And, you know, like it's always really interesting to be in a place where the alphabet is different, so you can't immediately read a sign. It's really disorienting. So it's a great place to try and be creative when you have this kind of blend of, you know, something that's very familiar and something that's very foreign. I like that uneasiness. Yeah. It's not for everybody, but for me, it's just like a great way to.
Was the intention going to Athens, was the intention to be inspired to create, to work on new music?
It was, yeah. I thought I'd go there and write all the songs. Instead, I, you know, went out a lot and kind of formed a new band with all these Greek musicians. And I ended up spending more time playing with these new musicians than I did writing. But it was the perfect sort of like breeding ground to go and come back and come back home and sit down and really get to work.
Talk about what's different about this record as the pre-press is out on it and the some of the stuff is released on iTunes and you can hear it. There's a different sound that's kind of percolating, if you will, from the albums that even some of the stuff we heard in the intro. Talk about the evolution of your first three albums to what we're going to hear with Rebound.
Yeah, I was the last album, especially, and I was kind of on this path to figure out what it was like to be a singer-songwriter in this like 1970s tradition of music that I love and that I grew up listening to. And I feel like the last album, I kind of like reached the pinnacle of that and did the best job of that version of me that I could do. You know, I recorded an album with the guys I'd been touring with. We recorded in like a homemade studio in a barn in upstate New York, live to tape. It's very warm and organic sounding. It sounds like five people in a room playing music together. And so for this, you know, I felt like I can't do that any better. And my reaction to that was, what's the opposite? What can I do that's completely the opposite of that? And my answer to that was doing something almost entirely alone and using all, you know, artificial sounds, including drum machines and synthesizers and recording guitar straight, you know, with the direct input and not using any warm, lovely amplifiers or anything. I wanted something that sounded very kind of harsh and had a sense of kind of alienation. And to quote one of my songs, just kind of sounded like it was nowhere and not coming from a specific place.
Was that difficult for you as a musician? Because you've worked with a lot of collaborators. You even mentioned the touring band for the last album, and mm-hmm. you worked with, even when you were in Greece, you adopted a new band. Was it a challenge to essentially embark on this project by yourself?
It was. It was scary, but also fun. You know, I wrote the songs and I recorded all these demos at home alone, and I spent, you know, a few months like really doing the kinds of things I would never do in front of somebody else, like try to write a lead guitar line and record it and spend, you know, I could spend 4 hours doing that. It was so much fun. That was fun to give myself the time to do that, where I would never give my, like, have the luxury of doing that in a recording studio, or I would never torture someone to have to listen to me trying to, like, you know, play the same guitar thing, you know, over and over again until I got it right. But so it was difficult, but it was also really fun, and I'm so glad that I forced myself to do that. And after I finished making the demos, I just kind of sat on it for a while. I didn't play them for anybody until I felt like, you know, until I was ready to share them, because I felt like I'd made the album and I was satisfied with that.
I asked the follow-up question just about when you did, you have shared it and you're getting great, like I said, great reviews for the album, and everyone is very excited about the music. How has that changed you in the way that you did get a chance to work by yourself? And obviously you had to confront the fears and the emotion that went into doing this scary venture. How have you grown as a musician with the fact that you had to do this project?
Like every album, as I go along, I just, you know, it's just a little bit of a confidence builder. And, you know, like I'm more excited to make the next thing because I feel like I know that much more, you know, and I don't know when that will stop. You know, like each time you do something, then there's got to be more, well, like, you know, like maybe I'm not going to be able to do better the next time. But for right now, I do feel like, oh, I have more, whatever kind of analogy you want to use, you know, more tools in my toolbox. You know, I'm excited to get it, to have it be out in the world, first of all, which it's only a few days now.
Yeah, so that's right. So Friday,
I don't want to get ahead of myself.
That's right. Friday, the album Rebound comes out. Saturday, Eleanor Friedberger will be at Lincoln Hall. She'll also be at Reckless Records in Wicker Park for an in-store on Saturday afternoon. Eleanor Friedberger, the pride of Oak Park, joining us tonight on The Download. Can't thank you enough for taking some time out to talk to us tonight, and good luck with the album and the show this weekend.
Thank you so much. Just beneath the desk, her pants didn't reach all the way down her legs. And you know what happened next? I said hi politely, and we went to talk for coffee. Yeah. And that was when I knew. Oh, that was when I knew I was wrong all along. Oh, that was when I knew. Yeah, that was when I knew.
Friedberger here. I really like the album, man. Rebound's good. That's an Oak Park product. And she's a, I mean, Fiery Furnaces with her brother, but also her career right now, she's like the darling of the indie rock scene. And she's doing it in, I think she says she lives in upstate New York now, but made her name in New York City. And, of course, like I said, the pride of Oak Park. There you go. Good for her. She's coming to Lincoln Hall on Saturday. She's also doing Reckless. That's cool.
You like to, you know, when you think of rock stars, you know, you think of them and they just, you know, playing their show and then a night of debauchery.
Yeah.
Not just driving back to their parents' house in Oak Park. I thought that was kind of funny that you mentioned that.
Do you, she's doing the record store show, at Reckless. What you, quickly, Zim, what's your favorite, record show, record store, in-store performance that you've seen in your life?
Oh, man, I'm going to say Kurt Vile.
Wow, there you go, that's it.
Yeah. At Reckless.
Yeah, awesome. I remember standing in line to go to Tower Records to see the Smashing Pumpkins. They were like acoustic, and then of course you can't get in, so all you see is a head. Possibly, maybe some music, you know. But it's just all about the camaraderie of being out there. But yeah, for sure.
Wow, they played Tower.
Yeah, the Tower Records on Clark Street,
yeah,
by
like in Webster.
Yeah, over there by DePaul. no longer there. Is that building even there anymore?
It's been a while since I've been in that area. Yeah.
It's hard to. They don't do enough fanfare. There should be like a billboard that said like for the tour. There should be some sort of rock tour, and it's like this is where the Tower Records. Because you never know.
I actually went on a rock and roll tour.
What?
Very similar. I got on a bus and. You go to various places like where clubs used to be and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, you didn't tell me about this, yeah.
And my favorite part about it, though, was that we were, like, in current clubs, you know, we'd go to Shuba. You went to Shuba's Metro. You go in the green room and, like, areas, you know, if you've never performed, you see all that kind of stuff. You go, oh, this is where Lounge X used to be. But my favorite part about the whole thing is, like, we stop at the corner, and I'm like, what? I wonder what this is. We're not too familiar. And it was just the guy who was hosting had to go drop off his taxes at the mail in the mailbox.
This is always the case when anyone's got a tour. One second, I got to do one personal thing. That's so good. If you guys give me one second, I got to just need to go talk to my girlfriend. I'll be right back. That's so good. So good. Yeah, we were talking about that because when Joy Division, Peter Hook, who was on the show earlier tonight, Joy Division New Order, when Joy Division was coming to town, they were supposed to come to town in 1980 on the tour for Closure. Or is it not the? Is it Closer or Closer? Yeah, Closer. And that's Love Will Tear Us Apart. And Ian Curtis killed himself right before that album came out. So they had a U.S. tour planned. And that happened, and that ended the band. But we were looking at some of the old stuff because they were supposed to play a place called Tuts, T-U-T-S, 959 West Belmont. That's where Joy Division was going to play. And it was sponsored by Wax Trax, and it was a whole thing. We saw it, found all this stuff online when getting ready for the interview. That's interesting, though, that's part of the rock club tour. I got to look that up. All right, coming up, Swap Meets. You ready? I got some stuff. I found some stuff. It's going to be fun. 312-981-7200.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Or it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman
and Greg Flam.
It's Wednesday night. Let's do it.
That's right. It's a Swap Meet. 312-981-7200 here on 720 WGN. This is the segment where Greg tells you what your junk is worth, your memorabilia, your collectibles. And we've always added a wrinkle. And the new wrinkle, which I love, is that if you have the best brag of the night, you get a pizza.
We'll give
you a pizza. 312-981-7200. Let's get those phones popping. Let's get those texts in. Send us pictures. Let's get going. This segment, of course, sponsored by Wolf's Flea Market. Greg, good to see you, buddy.
Great to be here, always.
Oh, man, I'm so excited about tonight because I said a little bit earlier in the show that I've been cleaning out the garage because it's the Schadenfreude, the comedy group I'm in. It's our 20th anniversary, so I'm getting all these pictures for social media and pulling all these old reviews and stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm finding all these knickknacks that we've collected over the years, and I'm like, oh, this would be perfect for Swap Meet, including, and let's start off, I talked about this item on the show before, but it is a Michael Jordan glossy, black and white, that my dad's friend, PT, he got it. He worked at one of the buildings downtown that Jordan, I think, lived in, maybe.
Okay.
And he got it signed, and he gave it to me as a kid. And I was like, oh, this is so great. And then I went, and I threw it in with the baseball cards and, like, ruined it.
Over the years.
Yeah. And did not do what you tell everyone to do, take care of it. So it's kind of messed up. But I found it. I must have found it at one point in my life because I found it at the bottom of a bin today. And it's Michael Jordan shooting a basket against the Nets. That's all I got.
Yep.
It looks like it's possibly at the old Chicago Stadium, although it looks like it might be on the road. But Michael Jordan signed it, and you looked it up, and it looks like it's his signature.
Yep.
Thousands?
Possibly.
Priceless? I mean, $50,000 we start the bidding at?
I say at least start at $100,000.
Seriously?
Yes. Very serious. The other one that won for $210,000, I didn't tell you, was signed to a person. So that actually like makes it
diminishes
less.
The value. This
and yours is,
no. is
not. Yours just has the signature, which
That's
is awesome.
My so. Dad's friend's like, I forgot Lenny's kid's name. Just say Michael Jordan on it.
That's great.
But this is great. So yeah, it's got a little bit of crease,
little
though.
Bend,
like,
yeah,
I got
that's
a little
all right.
Bend in it.
Put that in, you know, like a frame or a book, and it will straighten out over time, and it will still display nicely. So I think you start at 100. You might be surprised.
Gosh, you guys.
You know, and it's a promotional, like, black and white, glossy, like, headshot type. And those are usually a little bit more in demand than just a regular photo.
So that's amazing. You got a couple things going. All the great things that are on this program, people call in and text in and say, oh, I've got this great thing. And and you're like, eh, it's only going for $20.
Yeah.
This cookie cutter headshot that Michael Jordan signed a gazillion of these is worth $100.
But the fact that he didn't put to Justin, that makes it more valuable.
All right, well, I'm going to hold out. Hold out, wait another 10
Well, whenever
years,
you're ready to list it, let me know.
All right, I'll what do you got? What'd you bring tonight?
Oh, a few things. Season's picking up. So, you know, you obviously had Hook on from New Order, and it brought back the memories of The Cure and stuff like that. And I have this really rare Cure photo. It's a promotional poster for Boys Don't Cry, the club mix versions of it. You'll see this is a very iconic pose of Robert Smith of The Cure. It's kind of a shadow type silhouette.
Back towards us, guitar.
Yeah, but it's what makes it rare is that it's a promotional poster for that release.
Yeah, wow. It's got a very Edward Scissorhands look kind of going on here.
And the question I want to know is, has anyone ever seen Bobcat Goldthwait and Robert Smith in the same room together? Yeah, yeah. That's what I want to
know. Ultimate. That's a great poster.
It is. It's really cool. It's probably, you know, I would... What's that? Sell it for maybe 100. It could go upwards of 200.
Well, maybe we can just do a swap. I'll give you a Michael Jordan signed.
I could probably sell your. I could probably sell your Michael Jordan post or photo before this. The other cool thing is these Polaroid pop up like instant cameras that you know they.
Oh yeah.
I'll show you. They're normally like that, and I know on radio that doesn't help, but. They're basically instant cameras. This model takes the standard 600 film, and that makes it more valuable because the other cameras were SX70, and they're harder to find a film and so forth. But this camera will go for about 250 to 300. Yeah.
No way.
And what's really cool about it is when I open it up, Marshall Field tag.
Oh, there you go. It's got the receipt
so
on.
So that makes, you know,
legit.
To me, gives it value. I don't know about anyone
legit.
Else.
Legit.
I love finding something with a Marshall Field
tag. We've got more stuff to get to. Let's do this because we're running.
Yeah, no problem. We can move.
Break, and we've got some other stuff I brought in as well. And we've got people already on the line. Mark's on the line. We're going to get to you just right after the break. It's Swap Meet 312-981-7200. What do you got? What do you want to brag about? Your brag could win you a pizza, so stay with us. It's Swap Me 312-981-7200. I'm Justin Kaufman. Greg Flam is here at Two-Page Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. We're ready to get to it. We both have more stuff to share, but let's get the audience involved. Sure. Let's start with Mark. Mark, what do you want to brag about, Mark?
Good evening, gentlemen. Hey, you're going to have to put your thinking caps on here. I have a unique, one-of-a-kind item.
All right.
It's approximately 50 years old. I was at a dinner with Bill Veeck, and I had him sign the back of a white dessert paper plate.
Yes!
Paper plate.
Oh, I love it!
And still in prime condition.
Nice. Obviously, hard to look up a plate sign, but a Bill Veeck signature is in the range of 100 to 200.
Wow. When was this, Mark?
It was approximately, I would say, 45 to 50 years ago.
Wow.
Was he like, you know, I wish baseball players wore shorts? No?
I got this idea.
That's awesome. Yeah. All right, well, that's good.
It's a good one.
That's a good one, Mark. Good start. Yeah, I like that one a lot. That's a front runner. Thank you, buddy.
I like it. You bet. Have a great night.
Thank you,
great
man. Show. You too. Thanks. Oh, that was great, man. I'd love that. I love that kind of stuff. That's Chicago. I love it.
I think the paper plate puts them more in the running for the pizza.
Yeah.
Because it's paper plate. If it was China,
no,
maybe not.
I get it, but I definitely for the pizza. I love the brag. Anyway, you're having a meeting and you're like, you know what?
We're having
a good time. Let me sign this paper plate for you.
Right.
Let's keep going. Let's go to Carol. Carol, what do you want to brag about, Carol?
Hello.
Hey there.
My son has a George Blanda signed football. It's a regular full-size football.
Okay.
And it's signed by George Blanda?
And
it
just has his signature, or does it say to somebody or anything?
No, it just says George Blanda.
That's good. Yeah, that's a good thing. I'm going to guess.
Is Blanda the one with the square foot? Who is that guy? Remember that? The football player had like.
I have no idea. I hope you're not asking me.
Yeah, it was a guy who had like one of the football players had like a square, a punter with a square foot or a kicker.
Tom Dempsey.
There it is.
Yep.
Thank you, buddy.
Pete
coming through. Didn't he have to Google that one?
I know.
He's off the top of his head. What do you got on a George Blanda signed football?
Signature is going for 100 to start, 100 to 200 to start. I'm sure it was worth more earlier on, but it's just kind of fading
That's
a little.
That's pretty good.
But yeah, not bad. It's good that it only has his name on it. So
there you go. Thanks, Carol.
Good. Thank you. Bye.
All right. Let's keep going. I love it. Let's go to Sean. Sean, what do you want to brag about, Sean?
Hey, guys. How you doing? I have a comic book. The Marvel comic book is the Infinity Gauntlet. It's got the glove and Thanos on the cover. I'm not sure if the movie is based off of it. I was wondering how long it's going to be until it takes any price or if it's worth something now.
So it's the old Marvel comic book of the Infinity Gauntlet, the Infinity Wars, which the movie is somewhat based on, but not similar. Right? Or is it new? Is it just like, or is this one that came out right now?
No. It's the old one. No, it's the old one.
Okay.
That's, you know, it's so funny because I have a 10-year-old son and he's really into comic books. We've gotten into like learning more and more about the Marvel comic universe. And yeah, I find there's so much of this stuff. I mean, they don't even include the X-Men, that Infinity War stuff. What do you got on an Infinity Gauntlet?
One recently sold for about $2,000, but they did have it graded, so keep that in mind. And it was graded a 9.8, which is almost mint.
I just have mine in a box in a sleeve.
Is Thanos purple?
Yes.
All right, good. At least they kept the color. That's all that matters, right?
Yeah. So, obviously not graded and not stored the way you might want to keep it stored. You might be at like a $400 level right now, but I would think it's going to go up over the next year or two.
There you go. Thank you very much.
All right,
no problem. Thanks,
Sean.
Thanks for calling.
All right, man, we're killing it here. Tom, what do you want to brag about, Tom?
Well, hey, guys, how you doing tonight?
Great. Thanks, Tom. Man.
Well, I got two quickies. I got a 1969 or 70 Schwinn Stingray Fastback.
Wow.
Nice.
I know. Cool, huh?
Yep. That's
cool.
Yeah, some of the Schwinn bikes are upwards of $4,000. So the Stingray, you know, depending condition and how many, if the parts are all original, nothing has been replaced, things like that. You know,
it's all original, but it's not in real good shape.
Yeah.
But I didn't touch anything, you know.
Yeah.
I left it. It's got the original slick tire on it and everything.
Right. Nice.
As one does with a bike. Don't touch it.
Yeah.
Buy two.
I used to like to ride bikes with flat tires, so every time I got on it, I ruined them.
All right. What's your second?
The other thing I have is a Matty Mattel Super Snub Nose 38. That fires the little plastic bullets.
Oh, wow.
I know. And my uncle was a Chicago cop, and he gave me a shoulder holster for it.
Wow.
And I hung it in my garage, and everybody that walks in starts to talk, and they look at it and freeze.
Yeah, right?
It's hysterical.
That's wild.
Like, you're packing in the garage.
That's funny.
I'm packing in the garage.
That's right.
Well, what?
Those are fun toys.
What was the name of the gun again? I'm sorry. The Mattel?
Matty Mattel.
Snapping Snub Nose 38.
Okay, there we go. Snapping. All right.
And I would assume that it, just by the year of it, that it's not like the new kind where you have the everything has to be orange.
Oh, no. No.
Right.
I believe it's a copy of a Colt, one of the snake guns, you know, the Colt Cobra.
Wow.
Before they learned. you know what? Toilets make it aqua. Right. Let's make it orange.
That's wild. It's wild. There aren't. They're not as high as you would think. You can get them for $25, $30, honestly, the gun.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Depending on condition, if you had the box or anything like that, that might change it. Your bike, though, is the winner. I mean, that's, you're probably, even in your condition, I would probably think you're starting at like $750, maybe an auction and go for it.
There you go.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well,
see you on the bike.
So much,
thanks,
guys.
Tom.
Yeah, and
thanks,
do not get rid of that slick tire. That's a big plus on that.
That's right.
I'm still jealous of that. I always wanted one on my car. I just had to wear the tires out to get them.
Yeah, right.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for calling.
All right. Good start to this thing, man. 312-981-7200. We still got some people on the line. We're going to take our break here, get the news updates, see what's going on with the weather. Diane, we'll come back at you. We got some people on text as well. 312-981-7200. We'll take a break, come back, and continue the swap meet. And we'll talk about the other things I dug out of my garage bin, or as Rick Astley says, garage.
Right. I love that.
Bin. Greg Flam is here. Stay with us.
It's time for swap meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid, beard and your fingers and your nose. Today, you're a picker. Or it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flam.
Here we
That's
are.
Right. It's second the Swap half. Meet second half, 312-981-7200. At DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. Tonight, we're playing for pizza. The best brag, your collectible, your memorabilia, your junk. You get the pizza. And if you want to call up and find out what something might be worth, Greg is here, ready to rock. We've got some good stuff already.
Yep.
You got some other stuff you brought in tonight. The calendars.
Yeah, they're just 1954 and 1962 Rexall drugstore calendars. And they're kind of neat because they're kind of the longer calendars, but they have some of that Farmer's Almanac facts, and they knew the weather like the Farmer's Almanac.
That's
and
so
each
weird.
Day they had the weather on the calendar.
It was printed 8 months in advance. It'd be like sunny, Thursday, windy, Friday, blustery.
Yeah, and they're orange and white if anyone was looking for them. The thing that sold them was the Rexall name. People collect the drugstore stuff, so that's really more it than the calendar part. Anyway, so that was, and they're about 20, 25 each.
Nice.
So, yeah.
I've got a plaque, which is a mounted plaque of the famed picture of Mike Ditka in full Bears regalia.
That's awesome.
Flipping off the camera. Everyone knows this one. But what is special about this is it is mounted on a plaque.
I know. I can't find it on the
plaque. There's an unbelievable nameplate that just says, Mike Ditka says goodbye, in quotes, to McCaskey.
Oh, wow.
This must have been... This was found in a thrift store. I remember this, but this was done in 93 or whatever it was, when 92 when Ditka was fired.
That's a very iconic photo.
Classic.
I cannot find it in a plaque, but I've had that in the larger poster, and I think it went for about 100, 125 for the larger poster.
I'm rolling into cash.
You are. You're a roll tonight.
Yes. Jordan Ditka. Ditka.
Right.
Jordan.
It's that Chicago sports stuff. No.
Yeah.
I think you're at for that. I think it would start probably $80 auction on that.
I think it was found for $1 or maybe in a garbage can.
Mm-hmm. I just love how they did the printing with the plaque underneath that.
Diane, what do you got? What do you want to brag about, Diane?
I have Maymon Oso's autograph from his rookie year.
Nice.
Okay.
1951. He signed it, Orestes Manoso. I met him again in the 90s at a fair at work, and I said, the last time you signed my book, it was Orestes. He said, oh, I did that in my rookie year. But after that, I was Minnie. So I have a couple that say Orestes Manoso and a lot of others from 51. That's when I became a baseball nut.
Wow.
And I'll be 79 tomorrow.
Happy birthday, Diane. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Very nice.
Congratulations. There you go. So do we have a good birthday present for Diane? What do you think of autographs for Minnie Minoso and Nelson Fox? What do you got?
Can't find just a photo right now. I mean, I see signed balls and cards.
Well, Greg, way to ruin Diane's birthday.
I know.
And I also have Harry Creighton. Does anyone remember him?
Harry Creighton?
No, let's see.
He broadcast the Sox games.
Oh, nice, yeah.
On the radio in '50s.
Wow.
A long time ago.
I love that you got all this stuff.
Yeah, you were hanging around all the sports guys.
All right.
You know, you could meet them in the parking lot after the game because they just come out and go to their cars.
Yeah, right.
Yep.
It's funny. I was just telling, I think I was telling my 10-year-old son about Wrigley. They now, whenever they do like the broadcast in the fifth or sixth inning, they show that shot of the grassy park outside of Wrigley now and all the people who are... on blankets and enjoying their craft beer or whatever they're doing there.
Yep.
And I'm always like, that was a Yum Yum Donuts, and that's where they parked the cars, and you could go through the chain link and get Andre Dawson to sign your stuff.
I was just going to say, it was a lot of fun, and they had easy access. We'd throw the books into the buses of the visiting teams, and they'd all sign them and throw them back.
Nice.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
That's a good start.
All right, thanks, Diane.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Happy birthday, too. How great is that? Let's keep going. Let's go to Adam. Adam, what do you want to brag about, Adam?
Hey, guys. I bought a house about a year ago, and when we were gutting it, I actually found a pack of Lucky Strike cigarettes.
Wow.
From, I couldn't even tell you, but I knew the guy that probably smoked the pack, and it's about half full, so it's pretty vintage.
Wow. All right.
Oh, that's a good one. I like that.
Yeah, it's not your average.
Fine. I don't even know if they still make Lucky Strike, but
yeah,
I'm not
I don't
focused,
think they
so.
Do. I mean, I don't know, but it seems like Lucky Strike is definitely generational, or, you know, something that screams 50s, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, it was funny. I mean, it was literally in the ceiling, probably, you know, probably the tiles that I ripped out. I was like, oh, you know, outside of buckshot and bullets and stuff the guy used to make in the basement, there was a pack of Lucky Strike cigarettes.
I love it. He's
well, Lucky Strike is definitely collectible. The tins, you know, are everywhere, but they keep selling. The pack of cigarettes, though, I can't really find. I see the tins for like $200. I got six packs for $125. They don't have a year, though, but they're sealed. So I'm going to take a guess, and if you did an auction on yours, I would start maybe $30 and do an auction.
That's what a pack of cigarettes costs? Yeah.
Yeah. But it's half full, right?
That's hilarious. Yeah, right. That's what a pack of cigarettes costs now.
Yeah.
All right. Awesome. Thanks, Adam.
Thanks, guys.
That's a good one. I like that. That's kind of right in there, right?
Yeah.
It's close.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Let's go to Rich. Rich, what do you want to brag about, Rich?
I got a Schwinn bicycle from 1963. It's a 26-inch three-speed with the handbrakes, and it's a Corvette II model, and it's got the Schwinn speedometer on it and the package rack on the back and the head badge and the Schwinn reflector on the back are still in.
That's funny that you're naming all these parts, because as I was looking up in the break, the bike itself is like $300, but you could probably make more parting that out than selling it whole. Like the nameplate and just the pedals, the nameplate, just the various parts, you'll probably get more than $300 doing it that way.
Oh, yeah.
But it's time consuming,
cool.
Of course. But yeah, just so you know, sometimes the parts are worth more.
All right. That's good to know.
Yeah. All right. And it's got 999 miles on the
That's cool that you can still see that. Yeah, that's neat.
Awesome. Thanks, Rich.
Yeah. Well, thanks for calling.
All right, thank you.
All right, 312-981-7200. We got Matt who's on the line. We got a bunch of texts I want to get to as well. We'll wrap up the swap meet coming up after the break. You can see who's going to get the pizza tonight. Mm-hmm. Greg Flam is here at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. Stay with us. It's a swap meet here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wolf's Flea Market. In studio, Greg Flam. You can find him both at Facebook and Twitter, at DuPage Picker.
Yep.
312-981-7200. Right now, I've got a couple of front runners for the pizza tonight. We got Mad, who had the Bill Veeck signed paper plate.
That is awesome.
Also had Adam with the half a pack of Lucky Strikes he found in the ceiling of a house he bought.
Mm-hmm.
And then this could be a front runner as well. Let's go to Bob. Bob, what do you want to brag about, Bob?
Hey, I've got two items here. The first one is size 13 Air Jordans high tops, the original ones from like back in the late 80s. I played basketball in them a couple times, and then mostly used them as wedding shoes.
Oh, wow.
So, Air Jordans 85, got to be the shoes. Isn't that the got to be the shoes here?
The red and white?
Yeah, the red and white.
The red, white, and black ones, yeah.
Right, okay.
I love it. And are they used, or you feel like, I missed that, or are they?
Well, that's it. I played basketball in them a few times, and then I would go, anytime I was standing up in a wedding, at some time during the night in the reception, I would switch out of my dress shoes and into the Air Jordans.
Why would you do that?
It became my go-to thing.
I got it. It's a Bob thing.
And I put on a red bow tie and a red cummerbund with my rest of the tux.
Nice. And then they start playing the Parson front. Ding, 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 ding.
And then I would always have my picture taken with the rest of the wedding party in that outfit.
Oh, I like that.
And, you know, all the weddings that I went to, there was always, at some point in time, I was in those Jordans.
Love it.
They're slightly used. And then the second item is actually kind of an heirloom. My grandfather was a big baseball fan, went down to spring training for the Washington Senators, shagged down a ball that was hit, brought it back in, and had it signed by Ted Williams in the Sweet Spot and all the rest of the Washington Senators.
Oh, wow. That you'd probably want to have evaluated.
Yeah, so what about the Jordans?
But the Jordans, you're between 1,500, 3,000, maybe a little bit over 3,000, depending on condition you have worn them. I don't know. I'm sure for that amount of money, you could probably get those graded as well to get top dollar, and you might be $3,000 or over.
There you go. The
ball, I couldn't even guess on that. It could be, thousands if all those signatures, pan out.
Wow. There you go. Thanks, Bob.
They all pan. But my brother uses one of the guy's names on there, Frank Howard. That's like his phony name. Whenever he needs a phony name, he always goes to Frank Howard.
Oh, man. I love it. Thanks, Bob. I love it.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for
calling. I love it mostly because Bob and his family they've got something going on there. A nice little party. First, he's switching out outfits at any wedding. If he's just a guest at the wedding, he's pulling that. And then his brother's got aliases.
Yeah.
That's a strong game.
Stuff going on there, yeah.
Yeah. Matt, what do you want to brag about, Matt?
Hey, guys. I was feeling great until Bob talked about that ball.
What'd you got? Walter,
my ace in the hole, when I was 10 years old in 75, my cousin was a coach on the Bears, Walter's rookie year.
Okay.
And he said, do you want a ball autographed by the team or whatever? And I said, give me a ball unsigned because we'll play in the park with it. And he got me two autographed pictures, one of Walter wearing number 23 and one of Gary Huff, an old quarterback. And I met Walter in Hawaii in the late 90s or in the mid 90s when I was working out there. And I got to ask him, why were you wearing 23? And he said that his jersey wasn't ready that day. So they threw him 23.
How about that?
It's an NFL sanctioned picture autographed to Matt, your friend always, Walter Payton. Spoke to the man himself, and that was my verification. I've never asked anyone what it was worth because it's very sentimental. But
wow.
Cool, yeah. That's a very great cool story.
That's
very good story.
Cool. All right. Good one,
it's
Matt.
It's hard to obviously do anything with the 23 with that, but the story is great. I love it.
Yeah.
It's the story that, okay, it's the story of the picture. Guys, you got a great show.
Oh, thank you.
All right. I like that one a lot.
That was good.
Yeah, that's what this is, why this segment's so great.
Yeah,
right away, Peyton with a 23. Just the magic of that, to think about all the 23s in this town, Sandberg and Jordan, Devin Hester. Who else?
Ventura.
Oh, yep. Yeah. Pizza.
Coming from the Cubs fan to the side.
Yeah, right.
Guys, right?
I know. All right, there's a lot of text. I want to get to a couple things here. Jerry Garcia signed Bong. Okay, we'll skip on that one. The Olympic torch used at the Torino 2006 Winter Olympics.
Yeah, that we can find. It's about $1,200.
Nice.
Yeah.
There you go. Photo of Babe Ruth with fake beard.
That I could not find.
When he played with the House of David baseball team. I don't know if that's real.
Find anything.
Signed Playboy magazine from Pamela Anderson. First issue she was at featured.
Yeah, that is anywhere from 100 to 300.
All right.
Signed, of course.
All right. There you go.
Yep.
Wow. All right. So in the last one, let's go with John. John, what do you got? What do you want to brag about, John? Let's get you in.
I have a 1959 White Sox baseball signed by the whole team.
Wow.
That's a good team, too.
Yeah.
We just had Joe Knowles on. He was telling me all about the 59 team that was not a power hitter team. They were a bunch of average hitters who hit base hits, and that they didn't have anything special on that team.
Yep. I was listening for that. Oh,
are you
man.
Impressed, John, that I retained that information?
I am impressed. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about many times team signed balls. It's so hard to verify every signature on there. I mean, if you can't get them verified, then yes, you've got a home run. If you can't, if like three of them are auto penned, stuff like that, it really depreciates the ball to the point where it's almost better just to have one superstar on the ball than the whole team. But yeah, maybe have that checked out. I couldn't, begin to tell you. If they're all real, obviously you're in the thousands.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So have that checked
out. Very good.
All right. Thanks, John.
Thank you so much.
All right. 312-981-7200. I don't know why I give you the phone number. You're calling for Patty's show because we're done with the swap meet. Lou Malnati's is, of course, you're going to get a gift certificate of Lou Malnati's. You can find one of 40-plus Lou Malnati locations in Chicago. It's part of the Steve Dolinsky walking tour as well. Malnati's, loumalnati's.com. We give away a pizza to the best brag tonight. We've got Matt, who had the Bill Veeck paper plate. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Adam, the half a pack of Lucky Strikes. And then I think it was Bob who with the Air Jordans.
Air Jordans, yeah.
Which is really about the story that he changes into them at weddings.
The man of mystery. All these different personas going on.
He's like, I got to stand out. I don't know. If I'm just wearing a regular tux, no one's going to notice me. I got to do. What can I do?
I vote for the Bilbeck plate.
Yeah, I do too.
Just Matt, because it's a paper plate.
Yeah, it's awesome.
If it was China, I'd be like, yeah, probably.
Yeah,
not.
And the idea that you're with Bilbeck and you're having dinner and you're like, well, you think you could sign that dessert plate? Could you just scrape the ice cream
plus
off of
like,
that thing?
It's like, what, 50 years old? Yeah, right. The paper plate is still like 50 years old, man.
Matt, you get a pizza for your trouble, nice. for troubling Bilbeck for the autograph 50 years ago. All right, another great swap meet tonight. I've got a couple more bins to go through, mm-hmm. so I'm looking forward to the next week when we continue. Greg Flam?
Awesome, as always. Maybe you're on the rise now. You got good stuff coming in.
That's right. I should have a garage sale of some sort. Right. I got so much money now, I can't even stand it. There's so many
pieces. You got a couple hundred right in front of you there.
A couple of $100 right here. You can get Greg at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and on Twitter. Greg, mm-hmm. see you next week, bud.
See
you.